should we be moving more towards the utilization of non-invasive ventilation?
Was there a risk of aspiration during intubation?
Did they have high-flow nasal cannula on each arm of the study?
Are we going to be using non-invasive ventilation for pre-oxygenation?
Never bag a patient during this active period.
There's no way you could do a mortality trial with this.
Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. We are always so happy that you are joining us yet again for another CCPEM podcast. And like our other podcasts, we're going to talk about a hot off the press article that deals with a very common, in fact, probably the most common procedure we do in critically ill patients, certainly in the ED, and that is rapid sequence intubation, and also in the ICU. And we're going to focus down on an aspect of RSI dealing with pre-oxygenation. But before we dive into that article and talk about the take-home points and what this article may bring to our practice in RSI in critically ill patients, I have to bring in my outstanding co-host here. You know them so well, Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Rob Rodriguez. Tonight, Dr. Peter W. is doing some clinical stuff, so he will not be on the podcast, but we have another special guest joining us. He's been on the podcast before. It has been a little while since we've covered an RSI article, but we are so happy to welcome back Dr. Ken Butler. We've talked about some other airway and intubation articles with him over the years here on CCPEM, and we are thankful for him to be joining us. Ken, I'm going to go to you. Thanks so much for joining us here on this podcast. Really excited to have you contribute to this discussion.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for asking me. I really appreciate this. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I completely agree. Dr. Greenwood, how are things up north in Philly?
Well, things are wonderful up here in Philadelphia, Mike. Thanks for asking. And I have to say, I am so excited to have Ken on this podcast. Dr. Butler, I mean, he's so modest. He literally gave himself a 5-second thank you, Mike. But this man literally taught me everything I know about airway as a resident. That was a little over 10 years ago now. But between his airway courses, his national airway courses, the cadaver course, AAEM, you name it, he is just a hero of mine and a really good friend. And so I'm excited he's here because for our audience, this is really something special.
Well, John, thank you for saying that. But I have to say this, if every resident was like you, my life would be so much easier and I wouldn't have gray hair, but we'll leave it at that.
That's awesome. Well said, John. And as you would anticipate, Ken is just days back from an international trip that he took with Dr. Mattu down to South America to once again educate folks on airway stuff. So he's fresh back from that trip and right into podcast recording. So
let's do it.
All right, Dr. Rodriguez, checking in with you on the West Coast. How are things going?
Things are going great. I'm also honored to be with Dr. Butler. And yeah, things are pretty good out here. Start of wildfire season. And believe it or not, I did a very, very small part in putting out a wildfire a few days ago.
Awesome. Well done, Rob. All right. Well, let's get to the education at hand, the discussion at hand, the article at hand for this podcast. And one of the key reasons we're bringing Ken in here is, well, not only because we love him, but he's going to talk about some RSI stuff with respect to pre-oxygenation. And what we want to cover is an article that just got published in June here in 2024 in the New England Journal of Medicine. The lead author is Gibbs, and many of the other authors on this paper you will recognize quite well from studies we've covered here on CCPM in the past. The article itself, or the study itself, is titled Non-Invasive Ventilation for Pre-Oxygenation During Emergency Intubation. So as I mentioned, intubating, performing rapid sequence intubation is one of the most common things we do in critically ill patients, and ensuring adequate pre-oxygenation is critical for extending that safe apnea time and giving us an appropriate oxygen reservoir. So let's get to this particular article. Rob, I'm going to turn to you first. Set the stage for this particular study and what we're about to talk about.
Yeah, this is a great article. This is by a group of investigators. I'm quite envious of their work. So the background behind this article is that approximately 1.5 million critically ill patients are intubated each year in the U.S. And hypoxemia is reported to occur in up to 20% of intubations in the ED and ICU. and can be associated with cardiac arrest and death. As we all know, pre-oxygenation can increase the safe apnea time and decrease the risk of hypoxemia during intubation. The majority of critically ill patients are pre-oxygenated before intubation, currently with an oxygen mask, a routine face mask, or nasal cannula and a face mask, or some combination like that. These oxygen masks, however, do not provide positive pressure, and the actual amount of oxygen delivered to the patient is variable, especially when the mask does not fit properly. Now, we all know that bilevel positive airway pressure, or BiPAP ventilation, is an alternative to oxygen masks for pre-oxygenation, and they can deliver close to 100% FiO2 and can be used to support hypopnea and decreased ventilation. It is important to note that bilevel non-invasive ventilation can increase the risk of aspiration. At the present time, the international guidelines don't really make a clear recommendation as to the choice between BiPAP or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation and routine masks. And so that really question is unknown, whether oxygen masks or non-invasive ventilation are superior to one another, whether we should pick one versus the other. So that led to the objective behind the study, and I'll turn it back to John to orient us on that.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. So yeah, that's a great setup. And yeah, this is a really exciting topic and something I think that has probably been around for a little while in the sense of this idea of maybe even the concept has been described in emergency medicine, you know, this idea of delayed sequence intubation or essentially giving yourself time to pre-oxygenate with a little bit of PEEP. Obviously, it's been performed a little variably, so it'll be exciting to dive in a little bit how this group did it. But the objective here was essentially to determine the effect of pre-oxygenation with non-invasive ventilation compared to a standard oxygen mask. So this is like, you know, your flush rate flow non-rebreather mask, and look at the incidence of hypoxemia during intubation of these critically ill adults who were enrolled in the trial. So let's look at the methods. So this was a pragmatic, multi-center, unblinded, randomized parallel group trial. You got all that? That's a little bit of a word salad, but essentially, this is a multi-center randomized control trial. This was done at 24 sites. And if you break down the sites into different areas of the hospital, this was 7 emergency departments and 17 ICUs. And to be honest, these were largely academic medical centers with a few community centers mixed in as well. In total, these units were all within 15 centers in the United States. So what were the patients? Well, pretty simple, pretty straightforward. They included adult patients over 18 years old who were undergoing what looked like emergent tracheal intubation. This was not like a controlled thing in the operating room and involved the use of sedation and a laryngoscope. Okay, so pretty much RSI. And they excluded kids, patients who were incarcerated, pregnant patients, those who were already receiving positive pressure ventilation as a part of their care. So think of the patient with COPD, I'm guessing, or maybe CHF exacerbation who had been on BiPAP for a little while. Those who had existing apnea or hypopnea, weren't breathing all that much, had immediate need for intubation that precluded randomization. And ultimately, if the clinician determined that one of the pre-oxygenation methods was preferable, those patients were not included in this trial. So what the investigators did was they randomized these patients in a 1-to-1 ratio to one treatment arm or the standard arm. We'll just call that the oxygen face mask group. Now let's look at what the non-invasive ventilation group received. So oxygen operators were instructed to administer non-invasive ventilation from the start of pre-oxygenation until the initiation of laryngoscopy. And when you look at the supplemental methods, it looked like the range of time that took was probably 3 to 5 minutes. So pre-oxygenation looked like it occurred with non-invasive for 3 to 5 minutes prior to the intubation RSI procedure. They set the FiO2 to 100%. They prescribed an inspiratory pressure of at least 10 centimeters of water and an EPAP of 5. So that delta was at least 5 centimeters of water between PEEP and the inspiratory pressure. And then they set a backup rate of 10 breaths per minute to guarantee the patient at least received 10 positive pressure breaths every minute. Now, as far as the face mask group, the operators were instructed to administer supplemental oxygen using a standard non-rebreather mask or a BVM device without manual ventilation before induction from start of pre-oxygenation to the initiation of laryngoscopy. So, you know, I'm guessing that their BVM devices had some degree of oxygen flow going through them. And it appears that they administered at least 15 liters a minute. So remember, we've talked about this in the past, the idea that we should be cranking up the FiO2 and the flow rate so that we really should be hearing like it sounds like a fan in the room. So not setting it just to that 15 mark, way above that as much as possible. And it appears that's what they prescribed here as well. Patient in both groups underwent pre-oxygenation for at least 3 minutes before induction of anesthesia. And the protocol also allowed for the administration of supplemental O2 through standard nasal cannula or high flow to patients in either group during pre-oxygenation. And then during the initiation of laryngoscopy and from laryngoscopy until tracheal intubation. So essentially O2's up the nose, so apneic oxygenation was allowed. What was the primary outcome? Well, I actually appreciated this. The primary outcome here was simply hypoxemia during the intubation procedure, and this was defined as a SAT less than 85% during the interval between induction of anesthesia and 2 minutes after tracheal intubation. They didn't look at mortality here, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit, but for me, I like this. Secondary outcomes, they looked at lowest oxygen saturation during the interval between induction and 2 minutes after tracheal intubation. And they also had a few exploratory outcomes. So specifically, did any of these patients develop hypotension described as a systolic blood pressure less than 65, new or increased use of vasopressors, and cardiac arrest? And they also, as a part of most trials, had some safety outcomes where they looked at one of the real questions I think here was there a risk of aspiration during intubation? And this was reported by the operators who were intubating. Any new infiltrates on chest x-ray within 24 hours after induction? I think they're trying to get at whether or not there was micro aspiration or something that may not have been detected at the time of the procedure. And then the pulse ox and FiO2 24 hours after induction. So this was a pretty distinct group of patients with a fairly simple intervention arm in addition to standard therapy. And again, looking at the incidence of hypoxemia during intubation. So let's take a look. I'm going to go over to Ken and Dr. Butler. If you would mind, please tell us about what they found.
John, thank you. So let's go over the results. They did a nice group of patients. They have over 1,300 patients were enrolled in the trial. So that's a nice number. They broke it down just about on the line. The non-invasive group was 49% and the oxygen mask group was 50%. So they really broke it down to a 50-50, which is nice. The mean age was 61, which is nice. And 48% of them had hypoxic respiratory failure, which I think in this box is really so important to see how hypoxic they were, and does either arm of the two studies make so much of a difference. It's very ICU oriented because 73% were intubated in the ICU, only 27% were intubated in the ED, but we'll cover that a little bit later as we go. Nice job, 86% of the patients were intubated by a resident or a fellow, but they also said that the operators had a median of at least 50 prior intubations. So for me, and I'm sure John and Mike know this, I like to see that. I like to know the previous history of the intubators, how long it took them or how many they have under their belt, unquote. So their outcome was the hypoxemia during the interval between the induction and 2 minutes after the intubation to see who desat. So kind of interesting if you look at the numbers of what they did. The non-invasive ventilation group, 91%, and the oxygen mask group, 18%, had hypoxemia. So that's interesting. So the effectiveness of the non-invasive ventilation appeared to be greater among patients with a higher BMI. So it goes a little bit into their body weight, but of course it's still mentioned here, which makes me kind of happy. John, you mentioned the aspiration group. And for me, this was an eye-opener, because if you go down to the results and look at the safety outcome, the aspiration in the non-invasive ventilation group was just 0.9%, or just about 1%. But the oxygen mask group had a 1.4%. So I found that interesting because my thought as an intubator when I teach residents that we should never bag somebody during that apneic period because we're worried about them being in this fed state and vomiting. But here, and maybe because they were in the ICU, I don't know that if they weren't fed, but the oxygen mask group had a higher rate of aspiration. I thought that was kind of interesting. So it may change my practice on that. So I'm happy to see that. And then that's really it. That coins the results. Mike, I'll bring it back over to you.
Outstanding, Ken. Thanks for taking us through that. And just to circle back, that primary outcome, what John indicated, that hypoxemia occurred less in patients in the non-invasive group than those with that received that non-rebreather or oxygen mask. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So just to round out a few things in the paper, some strengths that identified by the authors. Ken mentioned this, a fairly large sample size of just over 1,300 patients. It was across multiple settings. So you heard 17 EDs and 17 ICUs from John. And well, 3/4 of those patients ended up being intubated in the ICU. And these investigators, given the number of patients, actually included an overall broad range of clinical conditions, with about half of patients being intubated for hypoxic respiratory failure. A few limitations, we always point these out each time we go through studies. Certainly with this intervention, it couldn't be blinded. So the study was not blinded. John mentioned this, alluded to this already, that looking at oxygen saturation readings versus a primary outcome of was there any significant patient morbidity or mortality? And we'll get into that momentarily. And then in terms of the overall number of patients that were evaluated or underwent screening, about 20% of those patients were excluded because they simply needed to be intubated quickly, which precluded randomization. So recall that when John was going through that in terms of those excluded, these weren't the patients that they needed to get in, intubate right away. So there is that particular limitation. And then overall, the exclusion of patients that were previously receiving positive pressure ventilation, John alluded to this, perhaps the COPD patient who wasn't improving on bilevel positive airway pressure and needed endotracheal intubation. So with that, a few strengths identified by the authors along with limitations. But I want to circle back to the three of you now. In terms of this particular study, we do this procedure, I would say, almost every day in our emergency departments. Pre-oxygenation is absolutely essential in terms of our RSI and avoiding poor outcomes, perhaps even that peri-intubation cardiovascular collapse. With this particular study, I'm going to pose to each of the three of you, should we be moving more towards the utilization of non-invasive ventilation for most of our RSIs versus the traditional non-rebreather? Rob, I'm going to circle back, starting off with you. How would you put this particular study together, and how would you incorporate it into your practice?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. This study is intriguing. I think how it's going to change my practice is I'm certainly going to consider non-invasive ventilation in patients who have a larger BMI, a higher BMI, and who do not have another contraindication to non-invasive ventilation. So I'm not going to use it in my trauma patients. I really can't imagine like having a trauma intubation where I'm going to suddenly bring in the BiPAP machine and try and do that 3 or 4 minutes of non-invasive ventilation with that. A lot of our trauma patients were intubating because of we want to get it done right away. So I'm definitely not going to use it in those scenarios. I suppose the scenarios that I would use it in are the gradually declining patient, increasing respiratory failure patient in whom I have time to set this up, and especially those who have a higher BMI.
Outstanding points, Rob. Ken, I'm now going to go to you. Your analysis and what you think about this overall, this study, and taking it back to the bedside. We're going to be working together next week, and I'm going to assure that someone's getting intubated. Are we going to be using non-invasive ventilation for pre-oxygenation?
You know, I tell you, I do like the study. I echo what the gentlemen panel have said. So I think that the dogma that I grew up in, and I'm sure I have taught John and you this, is that never to bag a patient during this apneic period. And this study kind of sheds a different light on it, that maybe it is safe to do that because they didn't aspirate as much as I thought. Now, we can break this down and look at altering preload and seeing if they cardiac arrested. Again, those were very, very minor. And again, the patients that were getting in the non-rebreather had a higher rate of that. So one, I like that. I like the study for that. And maybe we can do that. The only negative thing, if there is a negative, is that, as you well know, our rooms are not set up to do non-invasive. I mean, we can do it maybe with just a bag mask ventilation ourselves and do it the old-fashioned way. And the only thing that I would have liked to see on this study is that did they have high-flow nasal cannula on each arm of the study? And it says it was very operator-dependent the more I read into it. So, I mean, for me, that's my poor man's PEEP. Grant, you were not ventilating during that time, but at least we're supplying more oxygen during that apneic period. But again, to go backward, I kind of like that this may change my practice about ventilating during the apneic period to get a set up and not being so fearful that the patient is going to vomit during that period of time, because that didn't happen in this group. So for that, I like it.
Outstanding. Outstanding. John, you're going to bring us home here. You had alluded to a few things that you wanted to expand upon in terms of primary outcome. Expand away.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, number one, there's no way you could do a mortality trial with this. You know, we've talked about this many times in the past. Critical illness, there's so many links in the chain that to power this to find mortality would be a massive, massive trial. So I applaud the authors for looking at really what was the primary effect of the intended treatment, which was, did it improve the duration of an acceptable oxygen saturation through the RSI procedure? But I do worry a little bit, because since this trial came out, I've already talked to a number of residents, and also in social media circles, this whole thing of this is going to change the standard of care. This is not going to change my practice in a couple of ways, but there are some patient subgroups that I think there is value here. So one thing I noticed, and this came up pretty early in the discussion, was that a little under 50% of these patients were intubated for primary hypoxic respiratory failure, right? So these are patients have underlying pulmonary issues and probably needed some sort of extra support to pre-oxygenate them, whether that came by PEEP or whatever. And if you actually look at the one figure in the publication, the absolute risk reduction, the greatest risk reduction was seen in those high BMI patients who probably needed a little more intrathoracic pressure to recruit lung, and those patients with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. In the no group, those competence intervals, that almost crossed zero as if it almost didn't make a difference. And I don't know if that was truly significant or not, but the point being is that if they don't have primary hypoxemic respiratory failure, I'm still pretty comfortable if their lungs are pretty good doing standard pre-oxygenation techniques. I think that's okay. Practically, how I'd accomplish this, we are fairly fortunate that we have ventilators in our resuscitation rooms on standby, and we can perform BiPAP through those ventilator circuits. So it's not a separate machine that we have to wheel in and wheel out. So if that is available, I can use a BiPAP mask, set the ventilator up to be on pressure support, and provide patient that assistance while I'm getting my SOAP me mnemonic set up. Ken, that's a shout out to you. All my RSI drugs kind of ready, and we're going through the intubation plan with the resident. I can give that. So in those hypoxemic respiratory failure groups and high BMI groups, as Rob said, I think this is a great piece of literature to support its use in those patients, but it's not changing my practice for all patients whatsoever.
Well, I think the three of you have really made some outstanding and expert points in terms of this particular article. And John, what you were referencing is figure two, and I think that provides a lot of insight that we take care of critically ill patients a lot, every shift, certainly in the ICU, but every shift in the ED. And as we head towards intubation, taking this article now to our bedside, to that practice, and thinking about pre-oxygenation, probably really thinking more on the utilization of non-invasive ventilation for those exact patients that you, Rob, and Ken talked about, those that have a higher BMI for reasons that we've talked about during our obesity care, the obese patient podcast, those that have that acute hypoxemic respiratory failure, those are what seem to be the populations that benefit most. And then In those patients where you're providing supplemental oxygen, those with higher needs of FiO2 prior to intubation, those were another group of patients that seemed to benefit the most or had the best absolute risk reduction with the utilization of non-invasive ventilation for those 3+ minutes pre-oxygenation while you're preparing everything to hopefully have first pass success. So I do want to thank certainly the authors, congratulate Dr. Gibbs, his colleagues. This was termed, I didn't mention this at the beginning, but termed the pre-oxy trial. Many of you have probably already heard it, read about it. John alluded to it hitting social media. And I really want to thank the three of you for taking us through this article, dissecting it, really what were its methods, what were the results, and then really interpreting those results and taking it back and giving us really valuable pearls for our next few shifts. And well, those next few shifts, we want to welcome all those new health staff, new interns, and fellows across the country. They've started in their various positions over these last few weeks, and hopefully this particular podcast, as we start the new academic year, can already give you a leg up on the latest literature. So, gentlemen, my thanks. Outstanding, outstanding discussion. Please, any of you have any comments, questions, as we always say, shoot us a note through the website, and we'll be happy to continue this conversation. Thanks again for listening here to CCPEM. We will look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.